I want you and your company, HCS, to come here and convince us why we should be using iPads, because a lot of people here like Microsoft products, so I want you to convince us to use Apple.
Welcome to Command Control Power, a weekly podcast hosted by three certified members of the Apple Consultants Network, drawing from nearly half a century of combined experience. We talk shop, interview vendors and colleagues, and share what we've learned while operating our technology consulting practices. This is Joe Saponari of CIMAC, and my two co-hosts are Jerry Zygmunt of MacWorks and Sam Valencia of the HCS Technology Group. We also offer a weekly email newsletter, which includes show notes for each episode. Learn more at commandcontrolpower.com, and thanks for listening.
So you guys ever listen to Dan Benjamin and Merlin Mann?
Oh, that's a blast from the past. Not in a long time. I used to listen to that show, you know, pretty regularly.
I listen to those guys every week. Merlin Mann, he's not the productivity, getting things done kind of guy anymore. He abandoned that a long time ago, but he's still pretty funny, especially when they talk about living in Florida, because they both at one time lived in Florida. They frequently disparage that state. Merlin Mann has something called odds and sods, and so that's what I have today. I've got lots of odds and sods. I got a cold call from a client down in New Haven, which is the closest big city to us. He said that he had some sort of an issue where his Dropbox wasn't syncing. Could I come down and take a look at it? Because he's got a computer he's calling a server, and then he has a portable Mac that's supposed to be syncing, and they're supposed to be talking to one another. So I arrived on site. The guy had a Mac Mini, and plugged into the Mac Mini was an external drive that had all his creative files. He was actually an architect. He wanted to have these files start to sync up to Dropbox and then be able to see him on his Mac. So initially, my suspicions when I talked to him on the phone was that he had another tech company that's works around this area come in some years ago. And I think what they set up was symbolic links. So sometimes you can, I don't know if you've seen this hack, it works very well with Dropbox. And there's actually a GUI that can do this, that can make the symbolic links for you. And I think it's called Mac Drop Any. Have you guys come across that in your careers?
I've heard of it. I haven't heard that specific name. Doesn't ring a bell. But you're talking symlinks that are placed like inside the Dropbox to another location on
exactly.
the server?
Exactly. To another location on the Mac, and then Dropbox will happily back it up. So that all works pretty fantastically well up until the point of the release of Sierra and then subsequently High Sierra, where if you turn on iCloud Drive, everything just goes haywire.
And
Yeah. So if you were syncing files on your desktop, people frequently would do that or their documents folder into Dropbox using these symbolic links. Some months ago, Dropbox had sent out emails basically saying to people that if you were indeed doing some unconventional syncing, this would all fall apart at some point. It does indeed. So that's exactly what was happening. He had iCloud Drive on and nothing was syncing back to Dropbox. Luckily, he had signed up for a Dropbox Pro account and he had tons and tons of storage. He had something like some ridiculous amount of storage, like 5 terabytes worth of storage. And he was only looking to sync about just under 2 terabytes up to Dropbox with his external drive. So I've been down this road before, and I don't know if you've ever done a full deinstall of Dropbox, but there's a lot of little pieces of Dropbox, including a hidden file. All that information needs to be extricated, and really what solved it for him was to do a clean install of Dropbox on both his computer and his server computer to get the accounts seeing one another. So with the new Dropbox feature of Smart Sync, if you have a Pro account, it used to be you could go into your Dropbox account and you could turn folders on and off. And now the way Dropbox will work with a paid account is you see all your folders on your Mac, but they're not all downloaded to your Mac. So it saves you space. And if you want to get a file or you want to get a folder, you simply click on it. And then just very much like how iCloud Drive worked, it'll download that file or that folder to your Mac. So that worked very well for him because he was able to manage and see all the file structure on his portable MacBook Pro once we got this working for him. That was a success story. And during the course of doing this, I actually at one point reached out to Dropbox and I got somebody on the phone just to make sure that my I's were dotted and my T's were crossed. And I spoke to a very nice representative until we got really deep into it. And then this has never happened to me before. Their support individual hung up the phone. It just became just too much for her to handle. And I was being very nice, and I'm always very careful about how I speak to people who are offering support, regardless of how skilled they are. But she realized that she really didn't have some of the answers to some of the questions I was asking her. And so a few times she put me on hold. And then I think the third time that she had to go out to her superior to ask a follow-up question, she just basically abandoned the call. And I know that we didn't get disconnected. She basically walked away, and then I was kicked into the Dropbox survey, like, press from 1 to 5, your satisfaction with this call that you just received.
So, wow. Yeah.
I can't believe that's the first time that's happened to you, Jerry. That's happened to me plenty of times. I've been hung up on my support many times.
Well, I've hung up on them, but I've never had them actually hang up on me.
I think that should be part of this survey at the end. I think it should be like, if you've been hung up on, press 0.
So I was kind of off in the Dropbox weeds for a while, the Dropbox Pro account weeds, but it all started working again. And of course, really, everything didn't start to look like it was syncing back and forth until Dropbox did a full inventory on that near 2 terabytes worth of data. So initially, when you hook these two accounts up, they don't look like one another, you know, because he was basically signed into the same identity on both accounts. But of course, the file structure doesn't look anywhere like it should across the two Macs until they all do their full syncing.
Yeah, that can get pretty messy. I've been in a similar situation, although I don't think it was involving symlinks. I forgot what got me into this scenario, but I had to do the same deep cleaning of Dropbox. There's like those .dot files at the root of the home directory.
Exactly.
There's even like a folder, like a .dot Dropbox folder, I think there. It can be surprisingly large in some cases. I guess it's cached data and things, but it can be like gigabytes of stuff. And so I had like removed it, or I thought I had, and reinstalled it, and everything looked fine. And then I think the user like restarted, and something else happened where it suddenly stopped syncing. And I think it was referring to like a Dropbox folder in a different user account. Like somebody had done something in theory smart, like a previous consultant or something had changed it to just leave the Dropbox folder in this other user account and tell your user account to sync with that one. And we'll change the permissions and blah, blah, blah. We were basically deleting that old user account, telling Dropbox to use her, you know, the normal location in her user account. And it got to the point where it looked like it was working briefly, and then it stopped working, and I had to go deeper and take out some of those other hidden files. So yeah, it can get pretty messy in there.
Yeah, and it can be really persistent, and sometimes it's very difficult to actually extract all the little hidden files and folders.
Right, and that's the kind of thing that you almost have to like, can't just be like an iterative thing. Like if you remove just the preference file and uninstall it and then reinstall it, but you leave the .dot files there, then those can then write preferences that are wrong, and then you end up having to like go back, and you can't just like then remove the .dot file because now the preferences are wrong. So you actually have to like go back through and remove everything all over again completely and then reinstall it. And then, you know, it's like it has to be a really like clean from the start installation almost.
Agreed. You know, the interesting thing is that Dropbox does provide documentation on how to remove these individual files and folders, but they don't have a smart uninstaller, which would really be helpful.
You know what else drives me nuts with Dropbox? I mean, at least with one or two clients, I've had this repeat issue where it's like too easy to mess it up. This client has a folder inside their Dropbox called like Jane's files or something. And then, you know, the husband has like his own like Jim's files, you know. They each have their own Dropbox account, but they each share like this one specific folder with the other. From time to time, they'll like move stuff around. Oh, and they have an alias to the shared file folder on their desktop for easy access. So you double click on the alias and you get to the shared folder in the Dropbox. But they'll like clean up their desktop, and then that alias will go missing, and then they'll think like, oh, I know where that is, it's in the Dropbox, and they take it out of the Dropbox and put it on the desktop, you know, and then it's like no longer syncing through Dropbox, and it's just this like folder that's like a copy, a snapshot in time of these files. You'd think Dropbox would be able to say, hey, we noticed you like remove this from your Dropbox. In fact, I may have seen that in more recent versions. I wonder if they are getting smarter about that kind of thing. But it just seems like almost too easy to break Dropbox in some ways.
You know, I was in Dropbox hell there for a while, but I got it all squared away. And it was one of those deals where you can't charge the client for all the time that you've been basically screwing around with his Dropbox account. trying to get it to sync and trying to get things to come together. So I said, look, I've got to run out and do another appointment. Let me swing back here. And so I cut him a deal. So the next day the phone rings and I see that it's coming from this new client. And I'm like, oh man. And I was pretty sure that I put the matter to bed and everything would be working. And if it wasn't working then, it would be working within the next 24 to 48 hours where he would see all the files and everything would sync right across. It was in Dropbox. And I breathed a big sigh of relief. And he said, I bet you didn't think you'd be hearing from me again. My MacBook Pro, I was working after you left on that day, and then I was working into the early part of the evening, and I came back the next morning, and the screen was black, and I couldn't turn it on. He had left it open and operational, because I told him, the Dropbox really needs to keep on talking to the Dropbox server, so leave your Mac on at the end of the day, leave it plugged in, and just walk away from it. So he did that, and he came back in the next morning, and he couldn't get his machine to boot up. So, you know, obviously I had him do the SMC and the NVRAM to no success. So I told him his best bet would be to bring it to the Apple store. Spent a goodly amount of time with an Apple genius. This was recounted to me later. And I actually got the call while he was at the store. And I got to speak with the genius. But the genius opened up his Mac. And what was inside was a 1 terabyte Aura drive from OWC or Mac Sales. The genius had determined that the drive was okay. I noticed that he wasn't on the latest version of High Sierra. Like he was on like 10.13.3, and obviously he would need to go to 10.13.5. So maybe his Mac was set up to automatically install updates, and maybe that's what it did that night, and on reboot, for some reason, it wouldn't boot. Well, come to find out, there's a problem with the firmware on the earlier Aura drives. Now, not the Aura Pro drives, but the Aura drives. And Mac Sales is aware of this, and they have blog posts about it, and they have some beta firmware which is supposed to fix it. But really,
oh, beta firmware on an SSD sounds great. Sign me up.
With all the client's data on it, right?
Yeah, so, exactly. Right. No backup. No problem.
The client was trying to explain what was going on, and finally the genius like said, "Give me the phone." And I spoke to him, and he seemed very knowledgeable. And he said, "No, you know, this is a thing, and really the only way you can sort of resolve this is you need to upgrade it to the latest version of High Sierra with the original drive in." So you have to bring it up to 10.13.5 with the original drive, and then you can take the original drive out, the Apple drive, and put the Aura back in, and the Aura will start working. And I said, well, don't you have a work drive there that you might be able to at least get him up to 10.13.5 and then get him back in business? Because there's evidently a firmware update that needs to be pushed out to the Mac Pro that's present in 10.13.5. And I said, well, don't you have like a work drive you could use? And he said, no, he didn't. So I said, well, okay, we may have one here. So have him bring the Mac back. I said, I'm sure all his data is intact on the Aura drive, right? And he said, no, I deleted it.
Oh, and, my God.
Yeah, and it's one of those stories. And so, again, I don't want to throw this guy under the bus, and I didn't walk a mile in his shoes, but it seems more often than not, ask client, do they have a backup? And this gentleman did have a backup on a Time Machine volume, which was just like one of those little portable Seagate drives that he had, you know, for a number of years. So not necessarily the most trustworthy resource. If the client says, yes, I have a backup, then without in the blink of an eye, they just delete the drive.
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, I agree, Jerry, like you didn't, you know, none of us have walked a mile in their shoes. And I'm sure, you know, there's reasons for that and everything. But it seems to me like the analogy is you take out insurance on your house, and then because you have insurance, light a fire in the kitchen, you know, and like, you know, hope for the best because you got insurance, you know, you're covered. Like, why tempt fate? Like, why still, like, you have a backup, make another one before you do anything, right? I mean, come on. I don't know.
Well, that's
crazy.
That's such a great analogy. That's a fantastic analogy. I mean, as we all agree, we think long and hard before we delete the client data on the drive. And we don't make sure that we have one backup. We probably want two before we do that. Goodness sakes, how many times have you seen people or heard about it or in your early days of consulting, you know, where there's that happened. You only have one copy and it doesn't work. So what puzzles me is that there was there's actually technically nothing wrong with the Aura Drive except that it doesn't have the right firmware on it. But what gets the Aura Drive working again is to just put in, like I said, the original Apple Drive or any Apple Drive that'll fit into that 2013 machine and just upgrade the firmware on the MacBook Pro that needs to be done with 10.13.5. And then you put the Aura Drive in and it starts to work. So why delete the data on the Aura Drive? But so the client brought all this stuff back to the office and I said, look, I'm completely swamped today, but I can meet you the following morning. So I met him the following morning. The machine was intact. The Aura Drive was inside it. I had him look for the original drive. He couldn't find it. I don't know what happened to you yesterday, but deleting your data would be one of the last things I would do, be it as it may. So what I did was I came in there with a brand new fresh install of 10.13.5. I took Carbon Copy Cloner. I ran it through my machine as the conduit, and I basically cloned a copy onto the Aura Drive, and the Aura Drive booted. So then we just had to trust the force, Luke, plug in this clunky external Seagate portable drive and hope that the Time Machine recovery would work. I didn't do it through Setup Assistant. I created an admin account, and then I opened up Migration Assistant and plugged in his Time Machine backup. And it took all day. I would imagine that Seagate was really struggling to bring back all his data, but it did. And he was back in business. This poor guy, you know, within the last couple of days, like his whole world fell apart and we had to put it back together.
Yeah. The thing that fixed it or like helped it boot, did he come back from the Apple Store with the booting computer with no data or no, right?
It still would not
boot. It still would not boot. It was empty, devoid of data, and it wouldn't boot. So now he had two problems basically at that point.
Right.
So the solution was, I know I'm sitting here. As you're saying, it seems to me deleting the client's data would be one of the last things I would do. I'm sitting here chuckling to myself because it just seems so self-evident you wouldn't delete the data. Right. Like it's just funny that we have to have this conversation like at all. Okay, so that's the answer to everything, and it's just funny how much the Apple Store will like avoid going through any kind of third party recommendations. Like you have the instructions from OWC addressing this specific issue. Like you said, you just basically have to upgrade to 10.13.5 using an Apple drive or any kind of generic, you know, non-Aura, non-whatever other drives potentially suffer from this issue. You know, you have to essentially like just install or upgrade to 10.13.5 on one of those drives. You know, and then put his drive back in and you're good to go. They didn't have to clone or do anything at that point, but they just were so like reluctant to do that. They'd rather erase the data. It's just appalling to me, but we've been down that road, you know, quite a bit. And it reminds me, so first, just to close the loop on that, if I understand correctly, as we said, gave him a non-booting computer with no data on it. You had like a drive laying around that you could use basically just to install 10.13.5 on, just fresh?
Before I came on site, I had an external USB drive. I partitioned it for 1 terabyte and I put 10.13.5 on there. And I just used Carbon Copy Cloner. I plugged his machine into my machine, plugged this external drive, and just cloned a fresh installed copy over, and it worked fine.
Wow. So I'm just curious because it wasn't even like you had to run the installer on a drive with his machine as a host. You already had the bootable 10.13.5 fresh system. And so merely like cloning that system over to his Aura drive, you know, solved the issue. Like, I guess when you booted his machine to the external drive, I guess that must have like done the firmware update or whatever was needed to get the machine to recognize the Aura drive, essentially, right?
Well, my suspicion is it didn't need this firmware update that this genius was talking about. But what puzzles me is why they couldn't have cloned on a brand new version of 10.13.5 just like I did. I mean, I just did that because I just had a hunch that would work. You know, he was running High Sierra before. That's what didn't make sense to me. Yeah, he was running 10.13.3. And, you know, I was getting this sort of secondhand story from the genius that, oh, there's some firmware on 10.13.5 that needs to be applied to the MacBook Pro before it'll boot. And that just didn't sit right with me. And so I said to the client, I said, this is going to take about 20 minutes or so. I think this is going to work. And I just cloned it over and it worked great.
Wow. Yeah, no, that's awesome. The whole genius bar part of that story reminds me of an issue I once had with a client. It was very similar, you know, where there's some quote unquote third party stuff involved. And Apple, we rag on the Genius Bar sometimes, probably a little too much. You know, they also are not all that hesitant to throw us under the bus when they feel justified. And in this case, the client walked in with a Mac Pro. It was an older tower style, I think probably a 2011 or 2012 model Mac Pro, and it was running SoftRAID. And this goes a ways back. We used to have a best practice of running SoftRAID mirrored startup volumes on like mission critical machines. So if one hard drive, in these days it was hard drives, fails, you know, the other one can just pick up right where it left off. Or that was the theory. In the evolution of Mac OS X, I think it was the upgrade to 10.11 or 10.12 maybe, just had some incompatibility with SoftRAID. So the client of his own accord, you know, decided on like day zero to install 10.10 probably, 10.10.0, let's say, like essentially bricked his machine. It wouldn't boot after that. His data, same situation. His data was intact. He didn't know that at the time, of course. He bricked his machine by trying to do the update from Apple. And then his next step was he brought it to the Genius Bar. Their diagnosis was, oh, I see what's going on here. You have this third-party software. Who put this on there? They don't know what they're doing. You know, I don't know if they said that exactly, but they certainly gave him the impression that this was like some really like far afield thing for anyone to even consider doing on his computer, really non-standard and, you know, really suspect. And so he called me like from the Genius Bar, basically like livid, like, what is this stuff you put on here? What are you doing? You this means I have to go back to you. I have to pay you money to fix this and to upgrade, or, you know. And I'm like, slow down. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, first of all, like, this is why we don't recommend upgrading. You chose to upgrade. Second of all, you should ask us if you're going to upgrade. And then we'll say, not yet. We'll probably specifically tell you because of SoftRAID, for example. You know, these are like chances you would have had to save yourself the aggravation, but you didn't. It put me in the position of being on the defensive because the Genius called into question this whole, why would anyone do this? You know, we've learned from these things over the years. We're not willing to put ourselves in the position where SoftRAID startup volumes, you know, have this incompatibility with some future software upgrade or something, and requiring us to go on site and use a special installer or whatever the case may be. So we don't use it for startup volumes anymore, you know, live and learn. But you hope that somebody gives you the benefit of the doubt, both the client and the Genius in that case, and neither one did. So that was kind of frustrating.
Exactly.
Recently, we've been working with a client on an iPad proof of concept where they wanted to roll out iPad Pros to a bunch of sales staff for starters and then to grow it throughout the business. So we were working closely with a person inside the client and the Apple store to make sure that this rollout went smoothly and tested things and worked with them. And it proved to be, and it still is, somewhat of a more difficult experience than I expected, because they're heavy Microsoft Office users and very heavy Excel users and Outlook users. And I don't know what kind of experiences you guys have had on iOS with Microsoft products, but my experiences have all been positive, except to the point where we have complex spreadsheets that simply do not work well on iOS. You know, these sales grids that they're using have things like pivot tables in them and all this stuff to make them work properly. What we simply found is you open one of those up on the iPad and it says, this is not supported on this version of Microsoft Excel, which is rough because we've been pushing hard for this project to make it work and saying, yes, let's ditch your Windows laptops and let's move you to these iPad Pros, and everyone's in love with them and they love the look and feel of them. And I'm running into these stumbling blocks with specific items that they need on a regular basis. And that was something I didn't expect at all at the Excel part. The piece that I kind of saw coming, I guess, is Outlook. Have you guys messed with Outlook on iOS much?
Very little.
Very little. Yeah. When it first was released, but I think didn't they buy an app, like a pre-existing mail app? And it's like it shares like no code with Outlook, basically, right? It's just like a totally new thing.
Well, so it's interesting that you say that, Joe, because yeah, so Outlook originally for iOS was this completely neutered product that was just worthless. There was this product out there called OWA, which Outlook Web Access is really what that acronym stands for. But there was this third-party product called OWA that performed a lot of the tasks that Outlook for iOS couldn't do, like share calendars and public folders and things like that. So apparently, if I have it right, Microsoft acquired the product, put what they wanted to, I guess, for lack of a better term, into Outlook, and then promptly killed the product on the App Store. So, wow. And they didn't put all the pieces of it into Outlook. So Outlook still sucks. That product is gone. We made the determination after a bunch of testing to go to the literal Outlook for web. What we did was we created a web clip, a full screen web clip on the iPad, so they don't see that it's actually going to the URL. It just looks like a native app. And it goes to their OWA URL. They sign in. And Outlook for web is way better than Outlook for iOS. That's how crappy it
is. Wow.
That was incredibly frustrating. And I'm still dealing with challenges with that. That is a real difficulty because we want this to be a win. We want this to roll out well and for them to go, yes, this is great. Let's roll out these iPads everywhere else. But, Outlook I expected, Excel I did not. And it's proving to me that I guess I didn't go as in-depth as I have in these products in the past.
That sounds like a situation that I would not want to be in. Are they holding your feet to the fire because you were the one who sold them on this?
No, I was brought in as the person to help it along. And actually, my job became more of documentation. We started creating little videos on specific topics to help the staff learn. So basically, we post these different videos to their internal Box account. If a salesperson has an issue with something or has a question about how to work something, they turn to our videos first, watch a little 3 to 4 minute video on how something works. And then if they still can't figure it out, then they reach out to their internal IT team. It's worked in that sense that they love the little videos that we're doing for them and stuff. But thankfully, it wasn't me that brought them to the project. I was just signed on to it.
So was it the store that led them down this path? Who's to blame here?
No, I wouldn't say there's a blame because some of it you just don't see coming until you do some. And that's what the proof of concept is for. And the store was actually very good about this because they came in saying, all right, we want 100 some iPad Pros. And the store was like, whoa, wait a second. You haven't fully tested this. How about you buy a few and let's vet it? And so that was
really,
really smart on the store's part because they were like, well, we don't want an unhappy customer, you know? So they did something, I think, for the sake of the customer there. And I'm not saying the project is dead. We're just finding little challenges that we have to work around. And some of it could be use the internal apps like Numbers. That could be a possibility, but it all depends on the complexities of the tasks that they're performing.
Yeah, I mean, once you start using something like pivot tables, all bets are off at that point.
Exactly. But you know, I have to tell you guys something funny that actually came out of this, at least funny to me. We went into one of our first meetings with a bunch of the people from the staff, and they're people from different regions, so they don't all know each other, and they were doing introductions. And the person leading the meeting decided to come out with something lightweight to see if we could break the ice. So she asked who everyone's favorite superhero was, and when you go around the table, you introduce yourself and tell the table who your superhero is, right? It's kind of fun and kooky, whatever. We're all going with like these different comic book superheroes and stuff. And this one guy gets to him and he says, well, I think I'm my own favorite superhero. Okay, that's relatively modest of you. Well, you know, because I save you guys every day with my IT stuff and all this stuff. And you guys call me and I help you out.
Was this you?
Like, no, no. That's a bold statement to make. I'm my own favorite superhero. And that's because I save you guys every day.
Wow. Wow. No ego there.
Wow.
No shortage
of ego at all. I kind of sat there and stared at him. Wow, that's a big statement to make.
That's a pretty bold statement. Sam, the other funny thing about your story, I find this humorous that in this day and age, I think it's literally over 11 years after Steve Jobs originally introduced the web clip as a very quote unquote sweet solution to native apps on the iPhone. That is actually your solution 11 years later to install a Microsoft product on the iPhone. That is amazing to me.
Isn't it?
I think we need to bring it to John Gruber's attention as that old thing he likes to trot out every once in a while about Steve Jobs making that ridiculous statement. You know, there's some, I don't know, man, there's some truth to it to this day.
It points out the fact that Outlook for iOS is just still crap, is all it is. It's crap.
Yeah. Yeah.
The audacity of Microsoft to pick up that project, kill it, and then not put all the pieces into Outlook for iOS is just beyond me.
I mean, I think it's one of these things where it comes from like user surveys, allocation of resources. There's 99% of users use 80% of features or something. And you found like one of the few exceptions where clients actually need this stuff. Although that's not really the case with I don't think that's fair to say with Outlook. I mean, you're talking about basic stuff like shared calendars and like out of office messages and things like that, right? Like that's pretty standard stuff these days.
I could go on and on about the shortcomings of it. It is what it is, but we're trying to make this project a success. And I think it can get there. Don't get me wrong. I don't mean to be sour on the iPad because they are happy about it. They want it to win. It's not like the people at the client are like, wow, this blows. They're actually excited about using it, which works out well for me because it's a positive experience when I walk in the door. We're working hard to make it happen that way. And I'm not blaming iOS. I'm more blaming Microsoft in this sense, you know?
And what is your workflow, Sam, with this particular implementation for sharing those files? So let's say we've got a Excel spreadsheet that you and I have to edit. How do we get at that, the two of us? Are you using the Microsoft OneDrive?
Good question, actually. That's been a thing that we've been discussing. So Box is the way that this is going, not by outside direction like us, just as a matter of policy within the organization. They're going with Box, and that was another challenge. That's going to be their central storage point for things that they use. So we have the Box app on there, and we have it integrated with other pieces on iOS. And that seems to be working okay.
Yeah, we've done that with Dropbox before, and that's been a pain point. It works, but it's a number of screen taps, and it's a number of steps that you have to go through. It's not just two clicks and the file's saved, and you want to reopen it on another iPad, just two clicks and you're in again. You know, there's this little chicane that you have to navigate through to get in and to get out. And as long as you follow that protocol, it all works, but it's not easy peasy.
That was an interesting discussion that we had, because when using Outlook for web, when you go to attach a file, you see an option for OneDrive, which makes sense. There are connectors supposedly that you can use for other services. They inquired about them and they said Office 365 Enterprise does not have a connector for Box. But on the iPad, thankfully, you can add Box as a destination on the iOS side itself. So although it doesn't exist within OWA, just like you were saying, Jerry, you tap it and make it available like you did with Dropbox. Voila, there it is for them. So again, they're happy. We're moving things along. It's just finding a challenge, trying to bash through that wall and keep moving forward.
Our show title should be Microsoft Turd Polishing.
Well, you know, no. Sam, it's good. It's a good thing you're not in the position of having pushed for this rollout and like really convinced them that this was the right way to go or something like that. I mean, that's a much worse position to be in. And, you know, you're wise to avoid coming into it from that angle. And I think that's something that we as consultants learn over time. My typical position is to, if I'm trying to convince somebody of something, it's basically something that I've used at many, many clients, you know, to great effect, something I'm very confident in. Rarely will even get involved in a scenario or solution that I haven't actually had experience with. Well, we can try, but no promises. I mean, that's the best I'll sort of like guarantee. I think that's where you are here, and that probably saves you a lot of like otherwise it could be a really big concern if you feel like, you know, you set them up for this and it's not going well, and you know, you have that feeling in the background that they might not be very happy with you, and that's not the case here. So you're lucky for that.
I want you and your company, HCS, to come here and convince us why we should be using iPads, because a lot of people here like Microsoft products, so I want you to convince us to use Apple.
It was, in fact, the direct opposite. They were so hot to trot going there. The business team at the store, whoa, guys, you know, you have not fully tested this. We want to sell you just a few to test before you're coming back in the door fired up that you have 100 iPads that you can't do what you want with them. So, thankfully, that was the smart approach. And then I could come in as like still the cautious guy, you know?
Right. Like in line with Apple. But isn't that kind of surprising that Apple took that tack? I mean, they stand to, you know, sell 100 iPads. I mean, who doesn't just leap at that opportunity? So it's very curious that they were much more measured in their response. What do you make of that? Where did that come from? Just the wisdom of, you know, sales?
That the business team involved, especially a team that I've been working with, always takes that cautious and smart approach. I know, you know, we've had our ups and downs with our conversations with the stores here and there, but that's what has made my experience with some of the customers that have come my way positive ones, because they don't take the approach of let's sell as many as possible. Let's talk with the customer and even sometimes bring the consultant in first to figure figure out if this is the right solution.
Yeah, that's, I think that's music to a lot of consultants' ears, because it really is hit or miss depending on who you work with, and also, you know, how you work those relationships over time with the business teams. You know, that has been my experience with certain stores as well, where they are much more reserved. And, you know, maybe that's just evolved over time. I mean, there was a time when I think, you know, Apple on the corporate level was really trying to juice the numbers a little bit, or you know, I certainly looking for very high metrics. And, you know, that probably translated into the stores making more sales more casually or something than otherwise they would have in the early days. And, the, you know, these days, I think the smart business teams have learned the same lessons we've learned, which is to underpromise and overdeliver and, you know, undersell, if anything. I don't remember the last time we did a I Should Have Known This. One occurred to me as I was preparing for my trip, and I'm like diligently, you know, doing all my backups and making sure I have Time Machine working, and I had a fresh drive for it that was portable. And, you know, I'm trying to do my due diligence, and I wanted to partition a drive and have one partition be a clone and one partition be a Time Machine backup. Plug the drive in, brand new fresh drive, into an enclosure, connected to my machine. I use Disk Utility to partition the drive, and I'm running High Sierra. So of course, by default, the partition map was APFS because, you know, again, I was partitioning the drive.
Right.
I made the partition, I did the clone first, and then I said, all right, let me take Time Machine here and point it to this second partition. And I realized I was not able to do that, of course, because it was an APFS drive. Okay, no problem. You know, I've got to basically set up Time Machine and then I'll partition the drive. So I set up Time Machine. I erased the drive. This is just like a new backup, so I was able to erase it. I have other backups. Erase the drive, reformat it, now set it up as a Time Machine drive. And then I figure I'll partition it. So I, you know, set it up as a Time Machine drive, partition the drive. The clone partition, I encrypted it. And I wanted, of course, the Time Machine partition to be encrypted too. Did the full backup to Time Machine, did the full clone. The clone was encrypted. And now I want to go and enable encryption on the Time Machine drive. Can't do it. So I have two I Should Have Known This. One, and this is all because I'm just kind of doing this like without really thinking about it, or I'm just, you know, I'm going through the motions, and I realize this is all changed now, basically, with APFS. Time Machine will not back up to an APFS volume, and we all know that, but I should have known that in the moment. And secondly, you can't retroactively encrypt a Time Machine drive. And that's the other thing I should have known. You have to enable encryption when you first configure Time right. Machine to back up. Right, there's just right, no right. way to do it any other way. And it's, you know, and I made a note here that I think, Jerry, you may have mentioned this at some point, like somewhat recently, maybe in the last few months, because it rang a bell after I bumped into all of this. I hear like Jerry's voice in my head. I'm like, did Jerry bring this up on a show? I feel like, you know, one of your clients within the, in this scenario or something. Does that ring a bell to you?
It doesn't. I mean, obviously, hindsight's 20/20, and that makes perfect sense that you can't do it retroactively. But right. I don't recall a story where that I needed to invoke that.
You can take a normal volume, you know, just a normal disk, you know, partition or an entire drive in the Finder that's just storing whatever files, and you can just like right click and encrypt it with just like a normal volume with storing files like normally, so to speak. But I think the reason, like you're saying, you know, we should know this, it makes sense, is that Time Machine has all these crazy like SIM links and hard links and whatever going on behind the scenes. And that stuff, I can't even really imagine how the system would handle, like how is it supposed to encrypt that stuff? You right. know, it just, it inherently like makes sense that it wouldn't be able to do that. And I'm suspecting that APFS might have a way to do that because encryption is supported at the, you know, volume level. So it, you know, maybe would be able to handle that scenario better. But again, it doesn't support Time Machine, so it doesn't really help me in this case. But maybe if they eventually do support some form of Time Machine on APFS, you know, maybe it would enable you to, you know, turn on encryption after the fact. But, you know, both of those things bit me, and I felt like a little bit of, you know, a newbie going through the motions here, setting up my own machine to back up and clone and be encrypted. I had to really do it very carefully, and I didn't expect to have to be so careful with that, you know, from the start.
Yeah, you're going fast. Like you say, you're not thinking things through. You're doing this while you're driving the camper van down the highway, of course.
So that's right.
You got to keep your eyes on the road, and you're trying to format the drive and, you know, type with one finger. I get it.
So right, exactly.
We're going to cut yeah. you some slack on this, Joe.
It makes it hard to like also write down the, you know, the encryption key with a pen and pencil while I've got one hand on the steering wheel and the other, you know, the other hand typing. Yeah, it's a lot of things to juggle. So
I got a little follow-up on our show from a couple weeks ago, 10,000 Songs on Four Wheels. We were talking about configuration using the fuzzy slipper method, the Sam Valencia fuzzy slipper method. You recall that.
Right.
Or sometimes referred to as a fuzzy slipper approach. I did some fuzzy slippering with this Ubiquiti installation that I was going to deploy at a client site. So I did some configuration here at home. One of the things is if you use these Ubiquiti products, and a lot of you already know this, you really need WAN access to get that set up properly. So if you think you're going to do it in some little closed environment where the switch, you're going to set up the switch and the gateway and somehow get the cloud, if you're going to use the cloud key, get the cloud key working for the controller, and you're going to do that somehow on the LAN without taking over your WAN gateway, you can't do it. You need to pretty much commandeer a WAN port to get this all operational, and then you can be on your merry way, but it's impossible to do otherwise.
Yeah, I've thought about that too. Like, is there any way to fake it? You know, if I just, you know, it's like I wanted to just basically think of my network as the internet. And then what's the difference? Like, I'm kind of one level deeper, you know, and it, like, intuitively, like, it thinks you think there should be a way for it to sort of just like treat your network as the internet and for all intents and purposes, just like set itself up to take whatever IP it gets from your network and just like use that as the WAN address. But it's not as simple, just like you said. And we've set up in our office a port in our workbench area that just has a home run back to the server closet where it just directly plugs into our cable modem. So we end up having, you know, we have like a what looks like a LAN port on our network that is actually just a WAN connection to, you know, again, to our cable modem. So we basically have the ability to plug into our cable modem from our workbench and go ahead and, you know, set up something like a, you know, whether it's a Ubiquiti USG product or a Zywall or a Eero or whatever the case may be that we want to do in our office first. Exactly the scenario you're talking about. It's a great resource to have the ability to do that so that you're not trying to simulate the real internet. You actually have the internet just to plug into, because in that case you could do that with this setup you're describing, right, Jerry? You could plug into like your cable modem, and I should mention, just to clarify, we have static IP addresses, and so, you know, we have five IPs that we can use, and we're only using like two or three of them for different purposes. So we have a couple of spare ones, and we just have a note that lists our IP address that we can use. And when we plug in a device to that WAN IP on our workbench area, we can just use, you know, some spare IP address and go from there.
Right. That's very smart to do. Actually, if you were going to hook up an Ethernet cable to where you are right now, it would be pretty long, right? Probably.
Yeah, exactly. You know, right.
Back to the office, yeah, to that WAN port. That's very smart. And you were saying you only use a couple of the IPs. One of them you use for, of course, that movie sharing BitTorrent site you have there in your office.
Right.
And right,
we have a Tor exit node. We have a, you know, BitTorrent mining. I don't even know what you'd call it. Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, it used to be back in the day, you know, I had my mail server, you know, very proud to have like a mail server that we're self-hosting. And I forget what else we used it for. We have our network, our LAN, you know, uses one IP address. Our mail server used a different one. I think we had at various times other things like, you know, to experiment with. But yeah, you typically they assign you a block of five, and you might use two, you know, in a case. So
yeah, it's a great,
it's nice
use
to have
for
a spare.
It. Yeah, it sure is. Yeah. It sure is.
Because I wanted to chime in on that. Jerry, just out of curiosity, have you tried to double NAT it off your network? Like basically use a switch on your port to act as the internet and then attach the gateway to that and then create that network off of there?
It's a good point, Sam. I probably could have double NATed it and tried. Based on my track record with Ubiquiti, the stuff is so twitchy to begin with, to get pages to load and have things to come up. If something wasn't responding, I wouldn't be sure whether it was because it was the double NAT or something else was amiss. If I take that completely out of the equation and just tap right into my modem, I'm good to go. I just wanted to throw that out there. You just can't configure it on a LAN connection as a private network. You need to reach out to the internet for these pages to load properly.
Yeah, fair point. I was just curious, but I understand being burned before, especially you and I used to chat about even changing the IP scheme on the LAN would kill us.
Right. To get it off the 192.168 and move to 10.0 or some variation on that. You have to promise it a couple six packs.
Right. Which goes well with the fuzzy slippers. You know, as long as you're staying comfortable. I was in a similar situation. My first Ubiquiti install too, I had the same kind of issue changing the IP schema, and the instructions I was following seemed to assume that typical setup would be that you've got an existing network set up, you know, you've got an existing router, you plug it into the router, you configure the Ubiquiti equipment, you basically adopt the network schema. In the scenario you're describing, it would almost want to take on the IP schema of your home network, and it wouldn't necessarily be configured in such a way that, you know, would be set up for the client's use. So it definitely seems a lot cleaner to just have like a spare public WAN address that you can just use to set it up from scratch, like in whatever way, and following those steps very carefully, because it's not very resilient in the setup process to like any kind of deviation, at least in my experience. Jerry, earlier in the show, you brought up Merlin Mann and Dan Benjamin. And I remember the good old days, I think before we ever had any podcasts, I used to listen to those guys religiously on the 5x5 network, which was started by Dan Benjamin. I watched or listened to the old shows with Merlin talking about productivity. And I even remember a day when Merlin Mann came to the channel camp. I forget where it was, but it was an ACN Apple hosted channel camp for, you know, for ACNs and other partners. And they had Merlin Mann as a guest speaker. Were you there, Sam? Yeah. I thought that was a great get for the ACN program. And, you know, that was my kind of, initiation to productivity. And it's a little bit disheartening that my productivity guru has hung up his productivity tools and is no longer in that racket. I remember the days of 43 folders. You know, he had a great site all about getting things done, the David Allen methodology. But I never really had great success with David Allen. I think I lack a little discipline that would be necessary to sort of make that work for me. Those systems, I think, probably for that reason, never worked very well for me. So at the ACES conference in Baltimore, I was very interested to see that there was a productivity talk about somebody who I had not been familiar with, Jeff Porton. He has a new book out, Take Control of Your Productivity, brand new, just released. And he had a very interesting approach to getting things done in the broader sense of productivity that he kind of gave us a very quick and focused overview on at ACES. And I thought it was a really interesting system, and I wanted to learn more about it. And I was very glad to learn his book had been released in the Take Control series. We as ACN members are entitled to actually download it for free. You have to sign up with Take Control Books, and they're still honoring that ACN affiliation. And so if you're an ACN member and you want to download this book, Take Control of Your Productivity by Jeff Porton, or any other Take Control book, just get in touch with Take Control Books. You can download them. They're great material to have your staff read. It's, you know, you can get the book about Apple's Pages software. You can get a book about networking. There's all kinds of books that they've released that are very useful, I think, to us as consultants, not only to know about, to introduce our clients to, of course, but also for our own internal use. I've already downloaded Jeff's book, and I'm looking forward to reading it and exploring it further, because I think he has a very interesting approach to productivity that probably works better for a guy like me who's completely lacking in any kind of discipline.
Sam, do you know who Rob Brydon is?
Oh, man, this is no good for me. That sucks. No.
He's actually has this bit where he does Small Man Trapped in a Box.
Okay.
You kind of sound like the small man trapped in the box tonight.
Really little guy, right back there, now with this really small man right at the very back of my throat.
I have nothing to base that reference on, so I can't even tell if it's funny or not.
I don't either, but I kind of agree. I don't know what I'm agreeing to, but it sounds right to me.
Well, he does this almost like a ventriloquist type of thing in the old days. You know, learn to throw your voice, and you see the little caption of the guy in the box, and he's like, help, let me out. Well, he can do this with his voice, and he can make it sound like this voice that's coming from him is remote, and he calls it Small Man Trapped in a Box. Sidebar, is Sam still with us?
I don't know. I'm no, waiting for him to chime in. Say really, something, Sam.
Oh,
hey, man. There he is.
But I just can't believe. On mute.
That's good, man. I can't believe that I'm the one that has reliable internet right now. You guys don't know.